From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Along the southeast, the Colonial Pipeline is back up and running. The company was hit with a ransomware attack last Friday that shut down operation for days. President Biden has now signed an executive order to boost cybersecurity for federal networks, but experts warn that this hack reveals how pipeline cybersecurity, which falls under the Transportation Security Administration, has virtually no regulation. Let's bring in Robert Kanaki. He's an expert on cybersecurity at the Council on Foreign Relations and the former director for cybersecurity policy at the National Security Council. He's calling for the TSA to impose regulations immediately. And Robert, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
You're basically saying that the TSA is the weak link here. For the last few years, it's taken a voluntary approach to regulating pipeline cybersecurity. What warnings have gone ignored over the past two decades?
There's been a host of warnings. If you go back, beginning with some incidents between 2000 and 2010, where pipelines were quietly disrupted by adversary actors. And then in the last few years, we've had warnings, not only in the form of an actual incident that occurred that the Department of Homeland Security reported on a gas pipeline, but also the Director of National Intelligence has come out and warned in 2019 that China did, in fact, have the ability to cause a localized disruption, at least to our pipeline infrastructure.
So this has been a problem for quite some time. Does President Biden's executive order actually address the Colonial Pipeline hack?
This executive order really is a response to the SolarWinds hack that impacted federal agency cybersecurity and private sector enterprise security. So it's really not explicitly focused on pipelines or critical infrastructure. It's really about that other side of the equation, the business systems that keep our government running and our businesses running.
Okay, this was a ransomware attack, hackers trying to make a quick buck by holding systems hostage. And they managed to shut down a pipeline that carries almost half of the East Coast's fuel. How vulnerable are pipelines more generally? What could future hacks mean besides just gas shortages and higher prices?
Well, what's scary about this is, as this ransomware operator made really clear in a blog post, they had no intention of shutting down pipeline operations. They were targeting business systems. They were trying to make money, but they weren't acting as an adversary like China or Russia might in a geopolitical conflict with the United States. Unlike in other sectors, unlike in the nuclear sector or the power sector, we don't have any regulations for pipeline cybersecurity because they don't have that government forcing function saying, hey, you need to invest in this. This isn't an area where you can cut costs. This isn't an area where you have to take into account the fact that you are going to be targeted by our nation's adversaries for disruption, and you've got a plan for that.
Well, Congress has already responded to the concerns with plans for hearings. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm is expected to testify next week about this pipeline attack in front of the House Energy and Commerce Energy Subcommittee. You're calling for the TSA to exercise their regulatory power immediately. What does that look like?
The Department of Homeland Security and the TSA administration have had the authority to regulate since 2001, and yet TSA has never regulated. What I'm arguing is that it's time simply to use TSA's regulatory authority. It's not something where you necessarily want to start debating in Congress. Should TSA have this authority? Should the Department of Energy have this authority? We've got the authority. Let's start using it.
Can you parse out a little bit more what regulation would look like?
I think one of the things that we'd want to see first would be an investigation of this incident. So TSA is going to come in. They're going to investigate the incident. They're going to understand why it happened. And they will use that as the basis for making recommendations to other pipeline companies to secure themselves. Then I would like them to audit all the major pipelines in the United States for security to understand where they are. Maybe you'd find some that are in great shape that can serve as the basis for how other pipelines should secure themselves and could serve as the basis for building those regulations. And then the final thing is we've got to have reporting on incidents at pipelines. We need to know when a pipeline has been impacted by a cyber incident. The only reason we found out about this incident is because there was actually a disruption to supply. So we don't even really have a sense of how bad the cybersecurity is or how often incidents like this are occurring at the nation's pipelines.
That's Robert Konecki, an expert on cybersecurity at the Council on Foreign Relations and the former director for cybersecurity policy at the National Security Council. Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
And we reached out to the TSA for comment, and a spokesperson says TSA will work to close coordination with government and pipeline partners to evaluate the key factors from the cyber incident and determine opportunities to reduce and mitigate risk.
Well, this past Mother's Day weekend was nothing to celebrate for many people around the country. There were shootings in Colorado Springs, in New York's Times Square, Chicago, Phoenix, Baltimore, and of course many other cities. Gun violence surged last year in the pandemic, and those trends are continuing now. So how does all of that affect efforts to reform the police? Patrick Sharkey has some thoughts about that, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. Welcome. Good to speak with you.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
And let's start this conversation by defining some of the data here. You and your colleagues tracked gun violence statistics for the 100 largest U.S. cities since 2014. You say the results are sobering. What did you find?
We found that 2014, which is one of the safest years in the country's history, since that point, there has been a gradual increase in violence that has taken place in the vast majority of American cities, and that has really accelerated over the past year. So in a lot of cities, gun violence has doubled since 2014. It's really a stark increase in violence.
Do we know why?
I don't think there's a simple answer as to why. There are a set of factors that helped contribute to the decline of violence, including more aggressive policing, mass incarceration, as well as a mobilization of community organizations. All of these things happened from about the 1990s to around 2014 and really reduced violence, but they didn't deal with the underlying challenge of extreme urban inequality. And so when you have a setup that provides all of these kind of reactionary responses that rely on aggressive policing and mass incarceration, intensive surveillance, that's not a sustainable response to the problem.
Does that violence or even the threat of it act as almost like a cycle and affect the way that policing is done in those cities and perhaps even make policing more violent?
Policing becomes harder when there are more guns on the street, when there is a surge of violence. Police are more likely to be shot. Police also are more likely to shoot civilians in areas where there are more guns on the street. So everything about policing and policing reform becomes more difficult. And another reason why that's the case is because the public turns back to the police to solve the problem of violence. Lots of mayors are turning back to the old solutions of the 80s and 90s and really calling for more investment in police instead of new approaches.
When police shoot civilians, one thing we often hear is they justify it by saying that they felt threatened, that they feared for their lives, that they thought the person was armed even if they weren't. Do you think it's possible to make reforms in policing without somehow first addressing the number of guns that are out on the streets? I mean, is that part of the solution?
It is definitely more difficult to solve the problem of police violence and police shootings in particular in a time of rising violence, in a time when there are so many guns on the street, after we just went through a year where more people purchased guns than any other time in the history of the country. It makes everything more difficult. Still urgent, but it's much more difficult.
So what do we do? Because we know there's no easy solution to getting guns off the street, and many people believe those guns are keeping them safe.
There are a lot of steps that we can take to regulate guns more closely. And some states have done this. Massachusetts does a very good job of regulating gun purchases and sales and requiring licensing. And it's not a coincidence that Massachusetts has one of the lowest rates of gun violence in the country. So there are steps that states can take to better regulate and track guns. And there are efforts that can be done at the local level where police work with community residents to focus their attention on the small fraction of people within a community who account for a disproportionate share of violence. But again, everything is harder when there's such a high prevalence of guns. And so that should be a starting point.
So you say there's regulation. That's one option. There's not always an appetite for that in this country. You also hinted at sort of reimagining what public safety would look like in this country. What does that mean to you?
We actually have decades of evidence suggesting that local leaders, community organizations, nonprofits, and residents can be extremely effective in controlling violence within their communities. They can't do it all, but we have to take that evidence seriously. When you rely on police, you also create a situation where there's tremendous harm that's carried out through police violence and also through mass incarceration, intensive surveillance. So we're now at a moment where we can think about a different approach that includes police, but that really centers community organizations and local leaders as the central actors responsible for controlling violence within their communities.
Patrick Sharkey is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
After actor Chadwick Boseman died last August at the age of 43 from colon cancer, the world learned about the startling rise in colorectal cancer rates, specifically among men under 45. That's the age when doctors recommend regular screening.
I'm Ibram X. Kendi. I'm 38 years old, and I'm striving to survive stage 4 colon cancer.
You might be familiar with Ibram Kendi. He's a best-selling author and historian on race and racism. Kendi was diagnosed with colon cancer when he was 35 years old. He's now cancer-free.
My name is Paul Rawate. I am 45 years old, and I am currently undergoing treatment for stage 4 colorectal cancer.
Paul Rawate is a marketing consultant from Wakefield, Massachusetts, and he and Kendi were part of a photographic essay in this month's GQ magazine. It's called Scar Stories, The Toll of Colon Cancer. Rawate and Kendi's journey started the same. They both had symptoms, put off going to the doctor, and then when they finally did, colon cancer was the furthest thought from their minds. Neither were over 50, nor had they had a family history. For Ibram Kendi, the only risk factor was his race. Black Americans are 20% more likely to get colorectal cancer and about 40% more likely to die from it. Kendi remembers the first visit with his medical provider.
I shared what was going on. Of course, she asked about my medical history, my age, you know, my family history. And she stated that she did not think that this was anything necessarily serious, but it's important to rule out cancer.
Paul Rawate, who is Asian American, had a similar experience.
I had had an issue with some sleep apnea, but some of that was coming from kind of the weight gain from the blockage in my colon. We weren't quite aware of that when it first started. And all of a sudden, you know, there was this excruciating pain in my lower side. And as we kind of go through it, we spent close to, I'd say, almost 8 or 9 months before I even got a referral to get a colonoscopy.
Ibram Kendi says his reluctance to see a doctor left him feeling angry with himself for not getting checked out earlier.
And I sort of prided myself on being healthy. Like, you know, I was a vegan, you know, I exercised. And when I needed to value my health the most, you know, I didn't. And when I needed to do something that was uncomfortable and get this checked out, you know, I didn't. And I was just very angry at myself, you know, because of that, because I felt like I had been lying to myself.
And you, in many ways, are lucky, Ibram, because you're now cancer-free.
I am. I've also been working through almost like a survivor's guilt, you know, because of my luck. But at the same time, I think that has transferred into almost like a, you know, a survivor's courage, in which I'm trying to use my story to help others and to make some really drastic changes so we can really save lives.
Paul, how do you take care of yourself and be kind to yourself during all of this while also being there for your family?
You know, that's kind of the interesting part of the conversation, because they're kind of my driving force behind it. And I have to actually agree with Dr. Kendi on the whole part about the anger, because for me, at the time when I got diagnosed, things are going well. Your son's about ready to start school and things. And then all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, you know, we get a diagnosis in July. And that's where I think that's where for me, it's been a lot about the anger. And also just from my personal background, I mean, in California, before I had met my wife, I was a pretty good Taekwondo master. So for me, I've been able to use stuff that I've learned from sports and just different things to kind of be able to handle what's going on more emotionally. You know, it does take a toll on my wife and son, because that's why I think the hardest part of this is that trying to be there for your family and then watching them go through the fact that you might not be there in some amount of time or what have you. Because, you know, as we talk about numbers, as of this July, I'm 3 years into this treatment cycle.
I heard you agree with him, Ibram.
Oh, yeah. And especially, you know, about witnessing how difficult it was for them to hear this diagnosis. You know, but at the same time, in many ways, we became closer. My daughter is an example. She's 5 now, but she was around 2 years old when I came from home from the hospital after a major surgery and had all these bandages on me. And ever since then, she loves putting Band-Aids on herself. And so you talk about something, you know, those types of things in which, even though you're going through an experience, in that case, you know, recovering from a painful surgery, there's still that sort of humanity and being able to experience that with people who you love and who love you is sort of certainly gave me the drive to want to fight and to want to be healthy.
Both of you are revealing your scars, both literally in the sense of this article with these photos, and then also through your stories. This is an incredibly vulnerable position to be in. Paul, do you have any questions for Ibram?
Just, you know, for me, it's just kind of like, you know, I'm just amazed at how you've kind of done it for so long. So, I mean, you know, what are a few things that you might have done to kind of get yourself kind of set coming out of like maybe kind of stage of anger and the sense of where, you know, you've kind of progressed, maybe one or two steps you might have taken to kind of transition yourself like that, because, you know, things like that can maybe help me in the long run.
I think what helped just overall has really been, you know, really trying to pin my sort of self to the moment, to the day, to the hour. And so it's almost like, you know, you mentioned sports, like, you know, an offensive lineman has to focus on that first block and then that next block.
Exactly.
In order to be successful, as opposed to, oh, they can't envision scoring a touchdown, right? You know, you really have to sort of focus. I think that's really helped me, you know, along the way.
Thanks. That's well said. And like along the way, since I'm in a stage where I've been close to beating it, but like basically the reality is now I'm on a 6th line of treatment. And this one's working really well now that I'm back on it. But did you ever get to the point where you felt like it was impossible, like you were gonna run out of options and you weren't gonna get through it?
Oh yeah.
That's good to know.
And maybe I think this relates to just my work about bigotry, that it's very difficult for many people to believe we could create a world without bigotry. And it's probably impossible. But that doesn't mean we still shouldn't try to do the impossible. And I think
that's right.
I connected those two and I was like, you know, I'm just going to try to do the impossible. I mean, I don't have any other choice.
Right. That's true. I mean, yeah, we don't really have too many options. Either we're going to fight or we're going to give up, right?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned sort of your family, and what I've found is that it just can be very difficult on not only close family members, but even more distant family members or friends who just don't know how to respond, which is why I decided to just tell very few people, because people were so awkward. I'm just wondering how you're experiencing that.
You know, I have to say I follow the same pathway, because part of when I really started to talk about when I first got diagnosed, I was given the advice from someone who had breast cancer. She had mentioned that, hey, get a couple ambassadors and have them kind of spread the word. So it was pretty much open. Like, you know, I've got like friends of my father-in-law who are saying masses for me in Arizona. I've got like, you know, like one of my wife's best friend went to a Buddhist temple in Tibet and did some blessings for me. So I'm getting basically all the good vibes I can. But when it came to my friends in LA, because I'm, you know, I've got a really close knit group of guys from high school, a couple, you know, really good group of friends from college, it's been really hard. It was a kind of a slow rollout. And the hardest thing for people is when they look at me, you cannot tell that I really have stage 4 cancer. So that's been the other kind of reason why we've kind of started to be more open about it, because, you know, realistically, you know, things were getting a little precarious in 2020 for us.
Yeah. Yes.
Both of you are so generous and being so open and vulnerable. The whole purpose of this, what you all have been doing by sharing your stories, is to get the word out about screening for colon cancer. But going back to the realities, most people can't get this screening until they're 45 years old. Many people don't have insurance. Many people don't have doctors who are willing to give them the tests, even if they ask for it. What is your takeaway as people are listening to this and they say, okay, I'm ready. I'm no longer scared anymore. I'm ready to take that step. But they're stepping into a myriad of other barriers as well.
I just think you just can't take no for an answer. You should also be pushing for larger change within this community so that everyone is screened earlier, so that everyone has access to high quality healthcare.
Well, I think part of telling our story and getting this out there is to make people aware that if they're having similar problems to what they've seen and the signs that we faced before we were diagnosed, that maybe they would just have better information to even ask for that. So I hope stage one for us is to really get it out there and just make people aware of, like, hey, you can look for other things. If you're seeing these signs, go get help. And then after you get help, like, make sure you do everything possible to make sure your mind, your body, and your spirit are all strong enough to battle what you have to battle.
Paul and Ibram, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me as well. And Dr. Kendi, it was a pleasure to meet you. And I wish you all the continued success in your recovery and your journey as well.
Yeah, same to you, Paul. I'm just rooting for you and rooting for health and strength.
Ibram Kendi and Paul Rawate talking about their experiences with cancer.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
You're sampling the best.
You might have been just as surprised as we were when you heard that Tina Turner was inducted into the 2021 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. A few of us actually asked out loud, wasn't she already there? Well, like a few of this year's inductees, this is the first time for Turner as a solo artist. And after years of complaints that rock's female pioneers are underrepresented in the Hall of Fame, 3 of 6 slots this year are women. This year also brought the honoring of a mix of genres.
If you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a b- ain't one.
Joining us now is Maura Johnston, a music critic and contributor to the Boston Globe, and she voted for this year's Rock Hall's class. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tanya.
Well, there are 6 artists formally inducted into the Hall of Fame. They are Jay-Z, the Go-Go's, Tina Turner, Todd Rundgren, Carole King, and the Foo Fighters. But then there are several artists, including Kraftwerk and LL Cool J, who are receiving these other awards. What are these categories?
So the Early Influence and Musical Excellence Awards are ways to maybe honor performers who didn't get in through the straight balloting. Both Kraftwerk and LL Cool J have been on the ballot for a while, but they've been losing out to other artists like, you know, the Foo Fighters and Jay-Z. Even though I think that, you know, their influence on popular music cannot be disputed, I'm sure even Dave Grohl would agree, Kraftwerk's pioneering synth pop and LL Cool J's early hip hop records did a lot more to push forward the idea of modern popular music than the Foo Fighters, who are a great band and who I have enjoyed live many times, and I have enjoyed their records.
You know something else about this year, though? The Rock Hall is making a point of highlighting this year's diversity. Do you feel like this is late? I mean, it's 2021. The Go-Go's, for instance, had never been nominated before, despite making history 40 years ago with the first and only number one album by an all-female band, who also so happened to write their own songs and play their own instruments.
You know, it's a process of reaching out to voters who are younger. I mean, when I started voting back in 2012, you know, I was in my mid-30s, and that was, you know, young for this. And because it's been such a, you know, it seems like a long time, but really 10 years is not that long of a time for massive structural change to happen.
Hmm. So you've laid out for us this shift in the Hall of Fame acknowledging what is defined as rock and roll. What else surprised you this year?
I was a little surprised by Iron Maiden not getting in, I guess. Although I guess another recipient of the Musical Excellence Award, which LL Cool J got, was Randy Rhoads, the legendary guitarist who played with Ozzy Osbourne. And I think that metal is, you know, still kind of a scruffy outsider genre in its way, even though it fills stadiums and arenas.
The shifting change of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That is Maura Johnston, a writer and music critic based in Boston, talking about the 2021 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees. Maura, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You've probably noticed it's getting harder to find information about your school boards or street repairs. That's because dozens of local newsrooms have closed during the pandemic and hundreds more shut down before then. The Colorado Sun is trying to do something about it. The news site has acquired a family-run chain of 24 Colorado newspapers. The Sun has partnered with the National Trust for Local News to run these papers as a public benefit corporation. That means they can make a profit, but focus primarily on serving the public. Larry Rickman is the Sun's editor, and he joins us now. Larry, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And we're also joined by Elizabeth Hansen Shapiro. She's CEO and co-founder of the National Trust for Local News. Elizabeth, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Larry, I want to spend a few minutes talking to you first. Tell us about these 24 local newspapers in Colorado, why you wanted to acquire and run them.
Well, we're really so excited to partner with the National Trust on this endeavor. Community newspapering is so important. These are the only folks out there who are covering, in many cases, city councils, county commissions, school boards, and it's just absolutely vital to preserve those voices and to serve these communities. So we were thrilled at the opportunity to be able to step in and ensure that these papers go on and continue and thrive and remain in local hands.
24 papers across the entire state, small town, suburbs, that sort of thing?
Mostly in the Denver metro area, suburban newspapers. These are weekly and monthly newspapers.
Well, how close were they to closing?
Well, you know, they really weren't in financial distress. They weren't in a position of closing. But these days, in general, the first folks in line to buy newspapers are hedge funds, and nobody wanted to see that happen. So the owners of these newspapers were looking to move on. They're getting close to retirement age, and they were looking for the next chapter in their lives to begin. So we were thrilled to be able to step in.
You know, I think it's worth noting that you do have some personal experience with this, because in 2018, a hedge fund acquired the Denver Post, where you had been working, and that is what prompted you and other journalists to start the Colorado Sun. Give us a little bit of that history and how it laid the foundation for what you want to do here.
You know, it's sad to see what's happened with hedge funds across the country. So the hedge fund that owns the Denver Post also owns dozens of newspapers around the country, and they've just slashed and cut and laid off staff. The Denver Post, once upon a time, had 307 journalists. Today, it's down around 60 people. And back in 2018, we were ordered to cut another third of the newsroom. And that's when I decided, and a number of others decided, there had to be a better way, that we needed to find a new business model for journalism, that journalism itself wasn't failing, but the old business models were failing. So we set out on our own and created a digital startup, the Colorado Sun.
And your fear would be that something very similar would happen to these 24 local newspapers if left to the hedge funds.
You know, the playbook for hedge funds is sadly all too clear at this point. They come in, they lay off staff, they sell off whatever they can, and they squeeze every last dime out. We felt there was a better way. There was a better opportunity here to keep ownership local. We care about these communities. We live in these communities. We read these newspapers. I've said many times, when journalists are laid off, when newspapers close, it's not the journalists who suffer so much. It's the communities who are left without that voice.
Let's bring in Elizabeth Hansen Shapiro again. She's CEO and co-founder of the National Trust for Local News. Elizabeth, what is the plan here? Do you expect that you can keep these 24 papers operating as physical newspapers and not just digital platforms like The Sun?
It's important for many of these communities to have this paper land on their doorstep every single week. So we're not going to kill off print if it's what the readers want, if it's what the advertisers want. Our goal is to really expand the audience, expand the revenue, figure out ways to take the incredible service that these papers have done and build on them.
I guess the question, though, is how are you going to do this? Elizabeth, you wrote recently for Harvard that 1,800 publications have closed in recent years. What makes you think you can solve this problem of media consolidation? How are you going to pay for it?
What we are doing in putting these papers inside of a public benefit corporation is really changing the equation. So we're not expecting outsized returns from this acquisition. What we want is to continue to invest in the journalism, invest in the service to local businesses. And we believe that there's a real path to sustainability there that looks different from other types of papers that serve bigger communities.
Do you expect that you can make a profit?
We expect that we can keep these sustainable. You know, we're a public benefit corporation because at the heart of it, we want to serve the public. So this is not about outsized return to shareholders. This is about sustainability, low profit, and all of those returns going back to the communities, going back to the newsroom.
Can you keep everyone's job?
We believe we can. And in fact, you know, Larry and I are planning to hire, to build out the newsroom, to build out the business staff, because we see real potential. This is not a slash and burn operation. We're really about building and expanding.
It's also not happening in a vacuum there in Colorado. When I saw this news first breaking recently, I saw on Twitter a journalist in Arizona say, hey, could we do this here where we are? I mean, what kind of model do you think this presents to other places around the country that have also seen so many local papers close?
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of our mission at the National Trust for Local News is to keep local news in local hands. And so Colorado is our first acquisition, but we want to work with other communities and other places to replicate this model, because we really do think when communities come together, when strong journalists, you know, like Larry and the Colorado Sun join arm in arm with us, that we can make a new future for local papers.
Larry, back to you to finish it off. What's a sign of success that you've made this investment, you've made this decision to change the course of journalism there in the state? How do you know it's working?
You know, we will know that it's working by just, you know, continuing to do the great work that these papers are already producing for their communities. You know, I just want to say that none of us accept as inevitable that newspapers are failing and that hedge funds will take over. There is a better way. Communities can step up, and in this case, communities, you know, in partnering with local and national funders can make a difference. And we can find a new way to finance journalism and to, you know, maintain this public service.
Okay. And before I wrap it up here, I just want to make sure I understand the way you plan to finance journalism. Is this the model of selling ads that newspapers traditionally have encountered? Or are you going to try something different? Go to the community for individual support, that sort of thing?
We have a variety of approaches. I mean, these newspapers already have subscribers. They already have advertisers. But, you know, the point is that we all suffer when journalism goes away. And, you know, what's exciting to me is, you know, people are beginning to realize that. So what we're seeing are people from the community stepping up saying, we want to help. You know, whether that means, you know, as an individual subscriber or maybe as a philanthropist stepping up, there are ways, you know, that we can do this. So it's a combination. It's an all of the above strategy. We need to be creative in these times to find new ways to fund journalism. That's what we're doing.
Larry Rickman, editor of the Colorado Sun, and Elizabeth Hansen Shapiro, CEO of the National Trust for Local News. Both organizations have partnered to acquire and run 24 suburban newspapers in Colorado. Thank you to you both, and good luck to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, and speaking of local news, did you hear the story about the tiger that is on the loose in Houston? The 9-month-old big cat named India was first seen strutting through the front yard of a home in West Houston last Sunday. Deputy Sheriff Wes Mannion lives in that neighborhood. He was off duty, stepped outside his home, gun drawn, as the tiger slowly approached him. Terrified residents were watching, and they captured the moment on video.
A tiger in my neighborhood.
There's a freaking tiger.
He has a collar. It is somebody's pet.
He's about to attack.
Dude brought a gun.
Ooh, he brought a gun.
Oh, look.
Don't kill him.
Here's Mannion describing how it unfolded to KHOU 11 News.
The tiger looked like it was not super aggressive. It did stalk me across the road, but it did not look super aggressive. The last thing I wanted to do was shoot that tiger.
The deputy did not shoot the tiger, but here's where the story takes a turn. A man named Victor Cuevas was in the neighborhood when that video was taken, and at one point he grabs the tiger by its collar, puts it in his SUV, and drives away. Police tracked him down and arrested him. Cuevas is out on bond in connection with an unrelated murder in 2017. His lawyer told a local ABC affiliate that the tiger is not his client's, but that he does know the owner. But there's one more problem here. No one knows where the tiger is now, which, if you live in Houston, not exactly comforting, is it?
Illinois has passed new landmark legislation aimed at dismantling systemic racism in education. One part of this law requires expanded Black history lessons in schools. Illinois is one of three states to pass laws in the past year to change the way schools teach Black history. From member station WILL, Lee Gaines reports on the new law and how it will be carried out.
Brennan Hightower and her kids have a favorite history game.
So let's say I flip over two and I get Jesse Owens. So we have a match. You go to your book of heroes.
The goal of the game is to match historic Black figures and events.
I get to Jesse Owens and it gives me a little bit of information about him. It said Jesse Owens was acknowledged as an American hero after winning 4 gold medals in track and field events in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin.
Hightower, who is Black, lives with her family in Danville in East Central Illinois. She bought the game years ago, but still plays it with her sons, who are now 10 and 15. Hightower says the game inspired her to buy more educational materials about Black history.
Because a lot of what's being taught in the school is American or European. They're not getting a lot of the Black history or the African-American history.
Following protests against systemic racism and police brutality last year, a wave of legislation expanding multicultural education was introduced in state legislatures across the country. And 25 bills specifically involve Black history. In New Jersey, for example, lawmakers approved legislation that declares that school curricula has consistently omitted or misrepresented Black history, and the law requires expanded instruction on the contributions and accomplishments of Black Americans. In Illinois, the state's legislative Black caucus championed legislation addressing systemic racism in education. Part of the legislation, which was signed into law in March, requires schools to teach an expanded Black history dating all the way back to 3000 BCE. One of the Black caucus lawmakers working on this issue is State Representative LaShawn Ford.
I believe that when history was written, it was written with only one group at the table, white men. And so I think that this is not an attack on white men. This is just getting it right, realizing that it's from one lens.
Ford is a Democrat who represents portions of Chicago's West Side and Western suburbs. And he's also a former teacher. He says most Black history in schools begins with slavery.
But the truth is, we were born in a country where we were kings and queens, and we actually made major contributions to our country. And then we were uprooted, taken away from a culture, and our history was erased.
Ford says the law demands that students get a more accurate and inclusive version of Black history. Even though he's been working on this for years, Ford says the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor placed a spotlight on racial inequities and created an opportunity to pass the legislation. Some schools in Illinois are already teaching the kind of history that lawmakers like Ford want to see. Trayvon Parnell teaches African American history, an elective course at Central High School in Champaign.
We get an entire semester to really break down what exactly, why are Black people here, and what enfranchisement has looked like over the last, you know, almost 170 years.
Parnell, who is Black, applauds the new law, but he also worries about how it will come across in the classroom if teachers don't make an effort.
There's certainly a much more robust way of discussing the serious complexities of structural racism and the story of Black people. And there is really a wrong way to do it.
But the Illinois State Board of Education, or ISB, says the state will work with schools to help them implement the changes. ISB says the new history standards won't take effect until the 2022-23 school year. Jennifer Kermis is the executive director of teaching and learning for ISB.
We've learned a lot of lessons around the kinds of supports and tools that really help teachers to shift their practice. And that's what this is really about. This is about supporting teachers to achieve everything that they possibly can with every student.
Kermis says the state is responsible for setting the standards, which sets the expectation for what students should learn. It's the local school districts that determine how and what curriculum they're going to use to teach to those standards. Brennan Hightower, the parent in Danville, is pleased with the new law, but she says she'll continue to teach Black history at home.
Because I don't know how it's going to be taught. You know, I don't know who's going to be teaching it. And change is not easy for everyone.
Hightower says if Black history lessons honor and respect the legacy, it will benefit all students. And that's something she's looking forward to. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Gaines.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.